Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On this day after the national holiday that celebrates the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we talk with a Fresno musician and civil rights activist who shared the stage with Dr. King, Jimmy Collier. We'll hear from him a little later on. We'll also learn how mental health professionals are suggesting it's time for a new approach when talking about suicide. And we'll get the latest episode in our series Outdoorsy, this episode all about caving across Central California. We begin our show today, though, with a story about the intersection of global warming and the Valley's number one industry, agriculture. The Valley's fruit and nut trees need cold temperatures in the winter in order to go to sleep and wake up healthy in the spring. New research suggests that in as little as 30 years, it may be too warm in the Valley to grow these trees due to climate change. Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports that the agriculture industry is already taking the issue very seriously.
Tom Coleman farms and manages more than 8,000 acres of pistachios across the state. He's pruning branches that aren't budding on a plot of trees just north of Fresno in Madera County.
Here's an example of some hanging down nuts from last year that just wouldn't come off because of the position on the tree. So we want to remove that.
Coleman's worried these trees won't get enough sleep this winter. Crops like pistachios, peaches, and almonds need a certain amount of cold weather every year. Frigid temperatures between 32 and 45 degrees help set buds that in the spring will turn into flowers and then in summer into fruit and nuts. The problem is there's a decrease in the amount of hours growing areas actually reach these temperatures. Coleman's trees need to get more than 700 hours of sleep every winter. But for the past 4 years, many have routinely slept less than 500 hours.
And as a result of that, they do not bloom uniformly. And when they don't have uniform bloom, and it can dramatically reduce the yield of the field.
This is a problem that farmers are facing across California, and consumers should care, because if this keeps happening, prices for these products could go up. Predictions from multiple University of California studies say that within 30 to 50 years, it may be too warm to grow tree crops where they flourish today. One UC Davis researcher recently published a study in the peer-reviewed journal California Agriculture. In Hyannuk Lee's case study, she found that winter temperatures are increasing more than any other time of year. Her modeling looks at the year 2050 in Yolo County.
Our agriculture will continue, but if you look at the longer time path, like 20 years or 30 years, the pattern may change a little bit. Crops may move a little bit north.
She says tree crops like walnuts would be harmed the most, and that annual crops like tomatoes that are planted every year could benefit if temperatures keep rising. This is all a big deal for growers with huge investments in the ground with trees that have life cycles of more than 25 years. Merced County UC Farm Advisor David Dahl is trying a number of things to get these trees more sleep. He's using overhead sprinklers above the trees and even painting them white with liquid clay to reflect sunlight.
So this is something that could impact a lot of farmers over the next 10, 20, 30 to 40 years. And in fact, it's already impacted farmers, you know, on random given years across the state.
This problem is so prevalent that climate change deniers really can't get away from it. Crops have failed because of warming temperatures. In 2015, the California pistachio industry was hit hard. As a result, the crop was nearly split in half. The UC system and the pistachio industry have invested about $1 million to figure out a way around warming temperatures. Kern County UC Farm Advisor Craig Carlson is trying to breed a pistachio tree that needs less sleep.
We're trying to use the other species of pistachio, actually, to see if we can come up with something that has a lower chill requirement. It's pretty hypothetical at this stage. We've made quite a few crosses this spring. We actually hope to put a trial in a low chill areas.
It's not just pistachio trees that aren't getting enough shut-eye. Kern County farmer Steve Murray says his cherries may suffer this year due to our warmer winter.
Initially, it was looking like 17 was going to be a disastrous year because not only were the trees not getting chilling, but they were actually heating up when the sun hits the wood. That the temperature of the wood can be 20 and even 30 degrees warmer.
Murray says the only real way to fix this problem is for the temperature to drop. And to complicate things even more, all the researchers and farmers I spoke with say there isn't enough known about why the trees need sleep to understand all this. Plus, a decrease in the amount of fog in the region is also a factor in why the trees aren't staying cool. That has to do with rain. Back on Tom Coleman's plot of 160 acres of pistachios, it's rained so much that a large creek has formed in the middle of his property. He's hoping the ground is saturated enough that fog forms this winter, lowering the temperature around his trees.
The fog is a good thing because it keeps a little more uniform, cooler temperature on the ground, but we just haven't seen that the last several years, even with the rain.
For Coleman, the facts are evident. The climate is warming, and he has to adapt his practices.
I know that there's people that think that global warming is not man-made, but regardless, we have to deal with it. I think that making plans around it are necessary.
These trees that he's prided himself on since the 70s could live well beyond him and his children. He's taking warming temperatures seriously, because what happens with climate today could mean severe cuts or total crop loss in the coming decades. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. Every year in America, around 42,000 people kill themselves. Suicide is the second most common non-illness-related cause of death, but prevention advocates say the issue remains hidden and stigmatized. However, a series of high-profile events have brought suicide into the spotlight in the Central Valley recently. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports many suicide advocates say the key to prevention is in talking about it.
Three Clovis West High School students, a newly elected Bakersfield City Council member, and a Bakersfield transgender community activist, all have taken their own lives in the last 6 months. The issue strikes close to home for Carmen Vargas, whose father...
He committed suicide in a church in one of the rural areas around here.
And brother...
With my brother. Now, my brother committed suicide when I was 26.
Vargas herself even attempted a suicide.
I tried to take some pills and made sure that I had enough of them in my system. I went on the internet and I was like, what's a lethal dose of?
A last-minute change of heart caused Vargas to throw up the pills, saving her life. Now, when she hears stories about other suicides in the Central Valley, she recommits herself to bringing suicide out of the shadows and helping people understand what drove her and maybe help save a life.
That is all the pain that they can imagine right there. And can you think, the most horrible pain you have and think that it's never going to go away? If you had a toothache and you think, this is never going to go away. They're going to pull it out, but it's still going to hurt. It's that desperation of, how do I fix it?
Suicide prevention advocates say it's hard to generalize about what causes each person to take their own life. However, what they do say is that when these cases hit the media, it's an opportunity to destigmatize suicide, making it okay to talk about, similar to how cancer was once taboo. Stan Collins is a suicide prevention expert who works in the Central Valley. He says the biggest fear that needs to be broken is that talking about suicide will somehow tip a person into making the decision to kill themselves, when instead it can have the opposite effect.
That suicides can actually decrease and help seeking can actually increase. So when Robin Williams died by suicide, what we saw from that is a huge spike in visits to suicide prevention and mental health websites.
The Central Valley has a rate of suicide roughly consistent with the rest of the country. However, the numbers can fluctuate widely from year to year, and not every suicide is counted because sometimes it's difficult to tell if a person took their own life. Still, suicide clusters, like the one at Clovis West, and high-profile cases like the city council member and community activist in Bakersfield have health and political leaders saying the valley has to do more. Fresno County Behavioral Health Director Dewan Utecht says Fresno County is in the process of putting together a suicide prevention task force.
It's an opportunity for us to put the focus on why do suicides happen and what can we do collectively to address the underlying issues, because there's always a reason.
She says other places in the valley like Tulare and Kings County already have a suicide prevention task force. Last week, the mental health director for Kern County went before the Board of Supervisors to sound the alarm about the need for more suicide prevention. The state recently passed a law requiring every school district to develop a formal suicide prevention and response plan. Assemblymember Patrick O'Donnell of Long Beach, a former middle and high school teacher, wrote the law after hearing concerns that schools were not doing enough to help their students.
The plans need to focus on prevention, intervention, and postvention. Postvention meaning when an incident has occurred at a school or off school site, but to a student, that the school has a plan to address that too.
Most districts already have plans in place, but are now working to make sure they have formalized plans that comply with the state law before the start of the next school year. For Carmen, who survived her own suicide attempt, she just hopes more people hear the stories and talk about suicide with their friends and family.
My story isn't as uncommon as you think, you know. There is a lot of family members that, you know, have had that in their family.
For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
The issue of how to talk about suicide is also one that's shared by the media. Joining us now on the phone is Lois Henry, columnist with the Bakersfield Californian, who recently wrote about this very issue. Lois, welcome.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Doing very well about this very serious topic today. Bakersfield has recently been rocked by two very high-profiled suicides, Jay Bornstein, local LGBT activist, and newly elected city council member Jeff Tack, both recently took their lives. How do you think the Californian and other media should be covering these issues?
Well, in the case of both of those particular instance that you talk about, there was no way that we couldn't cover them. You know, I mean, you're talking about Jeff Tack, who was very, very well known in the community aside from being elected to city council. In fact, it was surprising he hadn't been elected to public office on that level before, because he'd been so involved in so many aspects of the community. Everybody knew that guy. You know, and he committed suicide the day after his first meeting. I mean, it's just so amazing. You know, you can't not say something about that. And then the Jay Bornstein situation, you know, it's just a tragic situation. She left home, and immediately the family knew that something was wrong when she didn't come home right away, because she hadn't taken, you know, her money and her jacket and her phone charger and all that kind of stuff. So they launched a very public search for her in a public park. You know, so there's just no way that we could not cover it. And I don't know. I've always kind of waffled back and forth on these things, you know, since I've been in the news business, and I'm sure since you started in the news business, the word was always, you know, we don't cover suicides. I mean, unless someone jumps off of a bridge into traffic and you can't help but cover it, or it's a super very well-known person like Jeff Tack, you just don't cover suicides, especially of teenagers, because the idea I was always told by my, you know, editors way back in the day was you didn't want to encourage copycat suicides. But as your piece just, or Jeffrey Hess's piece just sort of pointed out, the more you talk about it, the more people, you know, actually tend to seek help. So I kind of think maybe we've gone about this in a backwards way. Maybe we in the media have been complicit in sort of creating the stigma. You know, if we just constantly always, you know, say suicide, the S word, well, you know, it creates this sort of ugly mystique around it, maybe, that makes it even more difficult for people who are in pain to have the courage to seek help. I don't know what the answers are. Those are sort of some of my questions. I didn't really come to an absolute conclusion in my column, other than to say that in Jay Bornstein's case, we absolutely had to cover it. And, you know, we don't know why she took her own life. We don't. It could have been, you know, any number of reasons, but the fact that she was very involved in the LGBT community, she was very involved in speaking out against sexual assault and sort of calling authority on the carpet if they called sexual touching anything other than sexual assault. She was very, you know, sort of involved in that. So we can maybe surmise that her ending her own life had something to do with not feeling accepted and feeling isolated because of those issues, but we don't really know. But either way, you know, it's something that we do need to talk about. You know, because talking about, I'm just, you know, me, I'm a firm believer in more information is always better for the public than less.
What was the response from readers, both to your column and the Californian's coverage?
It was a mixed bag. I'd say, interestingly, I had more positive reaction, but there was still a lot of negative reaction. And some of our letters to the editor after Steve Mayer wrote about the funeral and covered some of the questions that were being asked at the funeral about community responsibility and all that kind of stuff. We got a sort of just a slug of really negative letters. You know, it's not up to me to accept their gender identity. You know, don't ask me to change my views because they want to be, you know, different. It's not up to me. How dare you wag your finger at me? And then we got a lot of positive response from people saying, yes, we need to talk about this. Because in my column, I pointed out that if Jay Bornstein wanted to wear a dress and grow her hair long and call herself she, rather than whatever she, you know, bits she was born with, okay, it doesn't really hurt me. And I don't have a problem accepting her for who she wants. I don't have a problem accepting people in general for who they want to be accepted as. You know, it seems to me like we want to put so many more silos around people than we really should. And we accept people in other realms, you know, not that it's a direct correlation, but if someone wants to be called Latino or Chicano or Hispanic or just American, that's kind of their right to determine who they want to be, right? I mean, I'm not in charge of them, and I'm certainly not going to try and be in charge of them. I'm barely in charge of myself. So that was kind of one of the points that I made in the column, and I got some emails, you know, back and forth. Mostly I got positive emails. And then, of course, a lot of people emailed me and said, you know, basically, how dare you invade this family's privacy at this horrible time of tragedy and pain. And interestingly enough, Jay's sisters emailed me saying, thank you, thank you, thank you for bringing this out and being sensitive toward it and, you know, not second guessing and not condemning. So so you're never going to please everyone on this subject because it is so intensely personal and so painful. And I don't know about you, Joe, but I've had a very good friend who committed suicide, and it was 15 years ago, and it still pains me to think about it and worry about what I could have done or what I couldn't have done, or did I reach out or did I not reach out enough, you know? Or suicide leaves everyone left just questioning and second guessing their relationship with that person. It's just extremely painful.
When it comes to Jay Bornstein's suicide, the one that immediately came to mind when I heard the news was the case back in 2010 of 13-year-old Seth Walsh, who mm-hmm. took his life in Tehachapi. Do you see parallels there? And has the community response, has anything changed in the interim in those 6 years?
I'd like to think something had changed. I mean, you have to remember that Jay Bornstein was an adult, 19, not, you know, fully formed, if you ask me. Most 19-year-olds aren't, but was an adult attending college, was very out, wore her hair long and wore dresses and, you know, was very sort of seeming to be in command of her own feelings and destiny, whereas Seth was 13 and still in school and being subjected to horrendous bullying. And we don't know that that was the case with Jay Bornstein. We haven't determined that at all. So there's a little bit of difference. And, you know, and Seth was really not in charge of himself. I mean, he was still a minor. And that district up there, as was determined by studies later, just had really horrendous bullying and didn't have a very good system for dealing with bullying. And hopefully that's changed in the intervening years, especially for that community. But, you know, obviously bullying still goes on. You can't legislate everyone's behavior. I think that, you know, because people just were just torn apart by this, you know, thought of this little boy being so horribly bullied that he would hang himself in his tree in his backyard. I think a lot of people sort of talked about things a little bit more, and it was you know, brought out into the open, not just suicide, but the idea of sexual identity and sexual preferences, and, you know, that it's not such a horrible thing that you want people to kill themselves over, so maybe, you know, relax your conversation about it. I think that that was kind of brought out, but, you know, we always still have ways to go. And again, we don't know why Jay Bornstein killed herself. We don't. And maybe that she left a note for the family, that the family's not sharing, it's, you know, that's their prerogative. We know why Seth Walsh killed himself, but we don't know exactly why Jay Bornstein killed herself.
Moving on to the other case with Jeff Tack, do we know any more about that? So many people are asking questions. How could this happen a day after that first council meeting when Karen Goh took the oath and Jeff was there and everyone? I was watching it online on the live stream. What do we know at this point?
Well, we learned a little bit at the funeral. Monsignor Craig Harrison had talked about the fact that he was taking Ambien. He was having some sleeping problems, and he was taking Ambien. And he, according to Monsignor Harrison, it changed his personality. And so that may be something that was going on. I don't know if he had depression issues, and that's why he was having sleeping problems. But Monsignor Craig did say that he was taking that sleeping aid and that it really changed his behavior and his attitude and his personality, because he was just always a really up and happy-go-lucky kind of character, as far as I know. I mean, I didn't know him well. I'd met him a couple times, like everyone in town seems to have met him. that could be it. We don't know whether he was having, personal problems or marital issues or whatnot, and again, we may never know. I don't know. I don't know if he left a note either. But yeah, it is just so, it was just shocking. I remember when I was out to lunch with a bunch of people, some sources, and I got, a text on my phone, and I sort of jumped up and went, "Oh my God, Jeff Tack killed himself." Everybody freaks out. Everybody at the table knew him, So
Certainly a very shocking story. Do we know what is going to happen as far as filling his seat? I understand there's a couple of different procedures. People are calling for a special election, I understand.
Right. The constituents, several of them have formed a little group, and they're getting signatures on a petition, because you have to have so many signatures on a petition to go forward with a special election. But I think that's going to happen either way, because the council was all in favor of doing a special election as well. So I'm pretty sure that's probably going to be the way it goes. Now, who runs, Harold Hance and I can't remember his first name, Nance, ran against Jeff. It was a three-way run for the seat initially. So I don't know whether those two guys will resurrect their campaigns or how it'll play out. I mean, it's just so sad, because Harold Hansen was so congratulatory, to Jeff Tack, because Jeff was such a nice guy and such a likable guy that you just, even though Hansen lost to him, he just was like, "Oh, this is great, and he's going to take care of the ward so well," and it's like such a positive transition, and we all are kind of just shaking our heads, wondering what the heck is going on around here, and what was happening in poor Jeff Tack's life. Everyone's really quite sad about it, even though he's a council member, and you think that's kind of a staid kind of a thing. He was just involved himself in so many charities and so many community activities that it's just shocking, still shocking.
Both cases certainly leave more questions than answers, and that likely will be the case as this issue remains a big one throughout our community, not just for public figures, but for individuals as at large. Lois Henry with the Bakersfield, California, joining us today on Valley Edition. Lois, thank you so much for taking the time.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Middle of the summer, bitten by flies and fleas.
You're listening to a song about the Watts Riots, a series of deadly protests against police brutality in 1965 in Los Angeles. The song's title, Burn Baby Burn, later became a rallying cry for the civil rights movement after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in 1968. The songwriter, Jimmy Collier, now lives in Fresno. But in the 1960s, he worked alongside Dr. King, using his music to organize civil rights activists. He wrote about the experience in a book published last year on the Chicago Freedom Movement. FM89's Kerry Klein spoke with Collier about the book and what it was like to work with Dr. King.
Nowhere to turn. Burn, baby, burn.
So your chapter in this book on the Chicago Freedom Movement is all about using music to organize and galvanize people, specifically around civil rights. How did you come to be using your talent in this way?
Well, I kind of grew up with the music, but my real interest was the civil rights. And I played music all the time, even from a young age, 11, 12 years old. But I really saw myself as an activist. Voting rights, housing, Title IX issues, issues about war and the climate. When I got involved in demonstrations, the guitar and singing and whatnot just kind of came to me. And I did it a lot. I mean, I sang everywhere.
And you were using music to also build trust, right? You know, you sort of described these times when you had to go out and canvass people, organize people, talk to people in communities. You'd be interacting with gang members, perhaps, and you'd sort of use music as kind of an icebreaker with them, right?
Right. I carried a guitar almost all the time, and people would be curious about it. It would. There's something about music that carries its own sort of vulnerability, I guess. And then when you're able to do that, it encourages other people to open up to maybe new ideas or joining the movement. A lot of times we would, if he was speaking somewhere, we would, be part of getting people there and organizing in that sense. And then I developed into kind of an opening act in some cases for him, because they didn't want people to know exactly when he was going to arrive sometimes. Not all the time. There were other people that traveled with him and choirs that opened up, but I did some as well.
And you were actually quite young. You were still a teenager when you met him, right?
I think I was maybe 19 or 20.
Yeah, it's amazing to get involved with something like this so young.
So young, and it's really sort of defined my whole life.
And do you remember the moment that you met him?
Yeah, I do. People came in sort of in groups, and there were other people that would sort of train us. And so it was a group situation. He came around, shook everybody's hand, and said some sort of inspirational things. I just kind of get an image of seeing him with his suit on. He always had a suit on. But yeah, I was thrilled, though. Yeah, my little heart was going pitter-patter, for sure.
What were some of the most notable qualities of his personality?
Well, just the way he spoke, the quality in his voice, his way he used words, it really was like music or something beyond. It just was a different quality. And, really good speakers are really, really good. And he was just, phenomenal. I mean, I don't know if he's the best speaker in the world, but it seemed like it, And I thought, well, this is where I need to be.
And you said that he actually helped you buy a guitar too, right?
My guitar was pretty battered up. And I remember him saying to Dr. Abernathy, "Can't we get Jimmy a better looking guitar?" So they gave me $500, and I went and bought a guitar, which got stolen out of a car, but I did get that acknowledgement. And he did marry my first wife and I in Chicago. She was a civil rights worker as well.
Wow, so he was the officiant at your wedding?
Yes.
Are there any memorable moments from, anything that he said during your wedding?
No, I don't remember. Gosh, I'm sure it was inspirational.
So this was 50 years ago at this point. How did you make your way out to California?
I had a band in New York. And one of the guys in the band was from Monterey. And so we'd be traveling like in Minnesota in the middle of winter. And he'd be talking about how great the weather was in Monterey. So anyway, one day I thought, I want to go out and visit this wonderful place. And I fell in love with it, too. I ended up working within a construction industry, and then I had a chance to work for a company that dealt with NASA and space programs and so on.
So when you look back at the 1960s, how do you reflect upon that time?
Well, I'm always gratified to see that anything positive came out of, you know, those demonstrations. And I just think that change in different ways takes a long time. We see a lot of cultural change, I think, in the society, but we don't see a lot of structural change.
Are you proud of being involved in trying to incite structural change?
Very much so. People step up in the time that they have to step up and do what they can contribute. And I feel like, you know, when I was young and had that kind of energy, I could take that kind of risk. When we look back at that period with Dr. King, it's kind of amazing what was accomplished with just a few people and a preacher that could preach real good. And that'll happen again.
Well, Jimmy Collier, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Learn, baby, learn.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A lot has happened in Fresno Unified since the last time we had Mackenzie Mays, education reporter from the Fresno Bee, on our program. Foremost, Superintendent Michael Hansen announced in mid-December he would be stepping down at the end of his contract, which is in mid-2017. There's a lot more drama here to bring us up to date. Mackenzie, welcome.
Thank you.
So this thing about Michael Hansen stepping down, let's go back to mid-December. This press conference is called. What happened?
So he says he is planning to leave in August. And I think it was a shock for a lot of people, although he has been superintendent for almost 12 years and the average tenure to be a superintendent is 2 years. So he says it's time. But the timing is suspicious, I guess, that the school district is under a federal investigation. There's a related lawsuit suing the district for no-bid construction contracts. And Hansen says it's unrelated, but other people are unconvinced.
And there's also new members of the school board and a new school board president. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in November, we got two new members who haven't came out and said they're against Hansen, but also are saying that they're going to hold his feet to the fire a little bit. And his biggest adversary, Brooke Ashton, was nominated from trustee to president. And so it's been a little intense since then.
Now, there was a very interesting scenario that played out a few days ago at a school board meeting. You were there. You said it was a little bit of an awkward scenario. Tell us what happened in the room.
Yeah, so last week before the public school board meeting started, President Brooke Ashton came out and instructed Hansen's chief of staff to move around the seating arrangement. So he moved the nameplate for Superintendent Hansen from the center of the school board down to the end of the dais. And this has been talked about a little bit. A lot of elected boards around here and across the country, I presume, have the person like the superintendent down at the end to signify that the school board is the employer of that person and not the other way around. But you could see that wasn't discussed with Superintendent Hansen. When he came out, he sat his things, his books down in the middle seat, had to be instructed to move down to the end. And so there were some critics there. They said it was sort of a petty move. And others said it was symbolic of, you know, turning around the direction of the district since Hansen has said he's going to leave. So
Hansen has now moved to the end of the table. It doesn't sound like that went over very well, but there's also more drama going on behind the scenes. There was a closed-door meeting last week. Do we have any idea what was the item of discussion?
Yeah, we do and we don't. So last week they met for about 2 hours in closed session. They came out with nothing to report to the public. And then tomorrow they're going to do the same. And the agenda says it's about an employee resignation or some sort of employment matter. It doesn't name the employee, but I think we're all guessing that it has to do with Superintendent Hansen. And the teachers union last week asked the school board to essentially fire Hansen instead of allowing him to resign. They're saying he doesn't need to stay until August. So we are assuming that behind these closed-door meetings that they might be discussing what the plan is there.
Now, there's also another drama playing out on another meeting front, and that's negotiations between the teachers union and the district over a contract. So what's happening there, and is this part of the overall debate?
Well, yeah, it's gotten pretty heated. The teachers union has actually asked in recent months to negotiate publicly, which is a rare move, and the district doesn't want to do that. And a month ago, the teachers union even suggested or hinted at going on strike. So it's definitely heated between these two groups, as it usually is, right?
So there's another interesting scenario that played out back in, I believe it was late 2016, a private meeting between Hansen and school board president Ashton and another member that didn't take place. Is that correct? They wanted to meet, but Hansen said he wanted his attorneys there, and that blew up as well.
Yeah, so when you get new board leadership, like new President Ashton and the new clerk, who is actually the newest trustee on the board, you meet with the superintendent. But in a memo that we were given, we found out that meeting couldn't happen because essentially people couldn't get along enough. The superintendent wanted legal counsel there present, and they said that was totally unnecessary and didn't want it there. But, typically you wouldn't need counsel. But, some people say you can't blame Hansen for the year that he's had with Brooke Ashton for suggesting that,
What has been the relationship like? Obviously, we've already characterized it as tense, as even maybe antagonistic. Is there a working relationship over the last 2 years between Ashton and Hansen? How did it go so sour between the two?
I mean, if there is a working relationship, I'm not aware of it. I've been here for a year and a half, and since then, Ashton has been the most vocal trustee. He's been calling for transparency. He's been really against, the FBI investigation, asking for the public to know more. And he does, blame the superintendent for a lot of that. Meanwhile, the superintendent says the FBI is no big deal. He says what investigation, he's really downplaying it. And Brooke is doing the opposite. So it's definitely no secret that they don't get along. And so if these closed-door meetings, if these are the conversations that are happening, I don't think anyone would be shocked.
Why did Hansen, did he say why he intends to stay on through August, at least back when he had his press conference last year? Was there some reasoning by essentially making himself a lame duck?
Yeah, he in his original resignation, he said that he was helping the district out. He wanted to help that transition process. But, usually you would get rid of the superintendent. The superintendent would resign, and then you get an interim superintendent who could stay for a year, a few months, while you perform a nationwide search for his replacement. And it sounded like he was offering to stay to do the district and the public a favor.
Is some of this also just the district playing a card, perhaps, in the negotiation game with the union? Is that something that people should consider as what all the cards that are going on behind the scenes? Do you think that is something that potentially could be happening? Or
I don't know.
Not to speculate too much. You're a good reporter there. not doing too much analysis here. what do we know about the efforts to get a new superintendent?
It's way too soon. At least that's what I'm told. So we would have to get an interim first. It looks like I've covered statewide superintendent searches in the past. And you usually hire a firm for X amount of money, and they do an independent search, typically nationwide search. So really the next step for the board, if they do push him out before August, which we don't know if they are, would be to get an interim in fairly quickly who would try to control everything while they perform the real nationwide search.
But that hasn't happened yet.
No, none of that's happened yet.
How did the rest of that meeting go last week, the one where they reassigned the chairs? Was there business being done, and were they able to work it out, work together in some way?
Yeah, no. You'd be surprised if you came to these public meetings. None of that. I don't know if right now it's a personnel issue, which is legally behind closed doors. But if you would have attended the meeting, it was business as usual for most of it. The public doesn't know what the plan is as far as the replacement just yet.
So what's the next step? There's another closed door meeting?
There's one tomorrow that I will be at. It starts at 5:30, but it will be, as far as I know, completely in closed session. And then, you know, law says that if you do make any decision behind closed doors, you have to report that out. So there's a chance that it will be deja vu and they'll come out and say nothing to report. And these meetings could be every week for months, or they could come out with some really big news.
Mackenzie Mays, education reporter from the Fresno Bee. You'll read about all of the drama behind the Fresno Unified Superintendent and Board situation in the Bee and online at FresnoBee.com. Mackenzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. The new episode of Outdoorsy is next.
It was so tight that you actually had to remove your helmet in order to be able to fit through.
Hey guys, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This is Outdoorsy, a podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to people who explore them.
Today, we're venturing to a different kind of destination. It's not exactly outdoors, but there's no heating or air conditioning.
It's musty, damp, and that's what some people love about it.
And often the only light source is the light you bring.
We're going underground. In this episode, we're exploring the world of spelunking.
But Ezra, I should say, people who do this don't actually call it spelunking. They refer to it simply as caving.
Well, no matter what you call it, in this episode, we'll meander through a threatened cave system in the region, find out all about the gear you need for underfoot activities,
and learn about subterranean spots in Sequoia National Park. Did you know there are more than 300 caves there?
In December, I went underground to a place called Millerton Caves along the San Joaquin River Gorge with a local caver.
That's literally right there where my foot was.
Yeah, I know.
The caves are about a 20-minute drive from Fresno, plus a 30-minute hike once you arrive. They're in an area where the river cuts through a steep canyon. A 13-mile trail runs along the river here. We took a shortcut off Aubrey Road to get there. You'll know you're there when you see huge piles of boulders on either side of the trail. Caver Paul Martson is showing me around the mile-and-a-half-long system, split up into three main sections. We're about 30 feet underground.
This is like almost like cathedral-like in here.
It is cathedral-like.
Yeah.
The cave system was formed by an underground stream flowing through granite, but it isn't accessible year-round, because when there's a lot of rain, the cave is roaring with water.
During the flooding, that's when it carves, and it's powerful enough to keep swishing the gravels around and keep digging down and down. It's like sandpaper, and carves these amazing shapes, and grooves, sharp edges. And if you hadn't seen it, you would have no idea that water is capable of doing something like that.
But the thing is, plans for a new reservoir above Millerton Lake are threatening the cave's existence. If plans for Temperance Flat go through and the dam is built, then Millerton Caves would sit several hundred feet underwater. That water would be used for farms and cities across California.
We have something that's so unique to this area, and really even in the world, and we're going to destroy it in favor of crops that we already have surplus of. And that just seems like a tremendous shame, because we've got gazillions of oranges, and we only have one cave like this.
Even if the project is approved, it's years away from being built. To listen to the story about Temperance Flat, visit kvpr.org.
So this cave system might not be around forever, but you said there are others in the area?
Yeah, there are so many caves in the region, but most are unmarked and many aren't open to the public. One that is open to the public is Crystal Cave in Sequoia National Park. It's one of the most popular caves in all of California. For the last 6 years, Katie Whiteman's managed that cave. She says there's more than 300 other caves in the park.
They're not huge. We don't have caves that go for 400 plus miles like Mammoth Cave National Park. But the beauty of these caves isn't necessarily in the stalactites and the stalagmites, but it's in the walls, that really beautiful marbled rock that you kind of wind your way through.
Whiteman loves to explore Crystal Cave in Sequoia. More than 65,000 people visited there last year, and it opens in May. The marble cave has 3 miles of passage, but only about half mile is open to the public. Other parts of the complex maze of a cave can be explored in special programs. Whiteman says her favorite section is usually off limits, It's called the phosphorescent room.
You turn off your light and you're kind of thrown into just this mysterious darkness. I remember sitting there thinking about how lucky I was to be sitting in a place that I couldn't actually see because it was totally dark, but I was a part of this journey that was protecting this darkness. And then it was really fun to get out because we had to squeeze out through this other passageway that you had to be completely on your stomach, and it was so tight that you actually had to remove your helmet in order to be able to fit through.
As one of California's most visited subterranean places, Crystal Cave often needs cleaning. But we're not talking about just candy wrappers and debris.
It's estimated that every visitor leaves about a belly button size full of lint when they travel through a cave. Kind of a disgusting picture, and that can affect not the only the aesthetics of the cave, where you kind of get this kind of like gray film along sides of the trails and these kind of lint balls everywhere, but it also affects the ecosystem. The invertebrates will actually feed on that cave lint.
So our belly button lint is feeding the underground?
Not exactly, Carrie. We're talking about dead skin cells, hair, and fiber left behind from our clothes.
That still sounds pretty gross.
Yeah, it sort of is. You know, but to stop millipedes and other bugs from gorging on that fuzz, crews periodically clean the cave. Last year, volunteers removed 1,300 pounds of lint from Crystal Cave.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's a lot of lint. Whiteman also says to prevent harm to caves, there's certain etiquette that visitors should follow.
The big thing is no touching. It's kind of a weird message just because you need to touch the cave in order to move around it. As cavers, we always wear gloves so that way the harmful oils on our skin don't come in contact with the cave surface and we're not disrupting any of those natural processes that help to form the cave.
Whiteman says the only thing you want to leave behind in caves are footprints. And for the safety of the caves, it's actually illegal to go into most of the other 300-plus caves in the park. You have to become a cave trustee to enter them. But that process is on hold as a program is being developed.
But never fear, though. There are plenty of other caves to explore in the Sierra. There's Boyden Cavern in Kings Canyon National Park, and many in Stanislaus National Forest and Kern County. The trick is that they're not always marked, so you have to do some sleuthing, or find someone who knows the area. And if you're looking to do that, I've found the guide for you. Meet Mark Balcom.
Scrapes and bruises are kind of standard.
A hiker, backpacker, and caver living outside Fresno.
My wife commented for the long time, that's how I know you had fun if you've got a scrape or a bruise.
He's a retired nurse, and he lives conveniently near Millerton Caves with his wife and his dog, Jim.
He's harmless but noisy.
He's been caving seriously for about 10 years, which means he got started in his 50s.
Why'd he start so late in life?
Well, he actually went caving once as a kid in Montana. He says he always remembered how fun it was, but decades passed and he just never got back out there. Until...
Went to a Sierra Club dinner a number of years ago and learned that we had a local cave club called the San Joaquin Valley Grotto and went to a meeting there and the rest is history.
He says joining your local grotto is a really good way to get started.
Find a grotto and ask if they can go on a beginner trip. People in the caving community are remarkably willing to work with you if you show interest and show up, but it takes some effort on your part.
Caving's not a solo sport, so getting involved really means finding your people.
Cave is a really bad place to get panicky because there's no quick, easy way out. So having people that you trust, you can use that as a tool to calm yourself.
You always want at least one person with experience, and knowledge about the cave you're exploring is essential. Mark says the ideal group size is about 3 to 6 people. That way, if someone gets injured, there's always one person to stay behind while another gets help. But if your group gets too big, he says, it can just take forever to get through tight spaces. He learned that lesson a few years ago.
There was one fairly big cave that we went to with about 10 people. And it was anticipated to be about a 5-hour trip, but some of the people had problems and we needed to take more safety precautions to get them through. And we ended up being there 18 hours. We started at 11 o'clock one day, and when we came out, it was about 6 o'clock the next morning.
I think I'd get way panicky in that situation. That's a lot of time underground.
Well, it sounds like when you're with the right people, you know how to calm each other and deal with surprises like that. Mark says they had planned to camp anyway and had pretty much all their supplies on hand.
Yeah, what kind of supplies do you even need when you go caving?
That was one of my big questions. A caving bag just seems like kind of a mysterious black box to me.
Cave harness, ascender, kroll, part of my frog.
So there's lots of fancy equipment you can get to go caving, but Mark says the most important supply is light. It can get dark in there, so every person should have at least 3 light sources, including a powerful headlamp and batteries.
I guess that makes sense, because if you need to change the batteries in one light, you need another light to be able to see it.
Exactly.
This is a helmet. Helmets are really handy. Caves are pretty hard and rocky. And
then there's the protective gear. Helmets, gloves, and a cave suit to protect your clothes and give you padding on your butt and knees. There's a lot of specialized gear, too, if you'll be climbing up or down, or if you expect a lot of water. But this whole time, Ezra, there was one question I was dying to ask, and I finally just blurted it out. Does he ever get scared in a cave?
Yeah. There are times that you're trying to go through a narrow space. I mean, what I call tight, which is, I'm sure, way beyond what other people tolerate, is, but when I have to exhale to be able to make forward progress, that's getting tight. And there are times when something gets stuck, a foot or an arm, and I really can't figure out what I need to do, and that's like, you know, panicking is not going to help you here, and there's usually somebody nearby, and gee, can you take a look at my foot and move it and see if I can get it free?
So why would someone put themselves through this, Carrie?
That's the thing. He loves this challenge, that experience of having to literally get out of tight spots.
There are unique places with unique life forms in it, and the activity itself requires doing it with a small group of people that you really need to trust and that special bond that forms. It's really a fun mind game. I mean, it's kind of like a form of meditation.
And that's our latest show. Check out our website for a list of caves and some information about the San Joaquin Valley Grotto. Share a picture of your favorite cave on Instagram or Twitter. We're at Outdoorsy Pod on both.
Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Bye.
And that's it for the latest episode of our new podcast, Outdoorsy. And that's it for this edition of Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed the program. As always, you can let us know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and also @KVPR and @Valley Edition on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook as well, Valley Public Radio, there on Facebook. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.